Comrades, this is the class of 2500 standing behind us. This is the class of new customer survey. We're going to stand on Jerusalem for the enrichment of your understanding and new customer on many references of the Packle family are the authorities on the Jerusalem model. And Mr. Packle is the resident authority today. She's a direct descendant from Salome. Several generations removed. You don't have to worry about anybody's head. We're safe from that, I think. Several generations removed. Or several generations removed. Well, I think we'll have a word of prayer, and then Mrs. Packley, you'll just take it and make sure they all know the names of those three powers in case they show up on next year's success. We shall be praying. We're thankful, Father, for your many blessings to us and your mercies. We thank you for sparing our lives to stay to know you and to do your will. Pray you bless our students and what they need to know and understand about your word and things related to it. Urge us, we pray then, to that end, in Jesus' name. Amen.
Okay. Everyone understand how to use the legend of the map. You look up the, say you're looking up TG, you find the section of T, which is tomb. You look up TG, and it's actually the garden tomb. Okay. If you're interested in reading up any more on Jerusalem when I'm through with this lecture, this book, which we've just purchased in the library, is not been put out on the shelf yet, but it will be very, very shortly. The World History of the Jewish People. This is a fantastic series, edited by Aviona and Svibara. Except Aviona is now dead, so the series is being edited by someone else in his place. I don't know exactly whom. This is a very, very good series on Jewish history, though. This is the Herodian period, this whole book. And it has virtually everything in it that you would be really interested in. It has a fantastic section on the temple and on the temple service. So if any of you are doing a paper in that, I would say this would be one of the first places you should go to. Also, it has a very long chapter on Jerusalem, which deals a great deal with its topography, the history of the walls, and so forth. Not as much with separate sites inside the city, but somewhat with that. First, I would like to tell you something about where we get our information about Jerusalem, the major sources. Of course, one of the major primary sources is the New Testament itself, and for that matter, the Old Testament. But as you know from reading the Bible, it's not a geography book. And very frequently we'll mention a place or a spot in Jerusalem, but it gives no location for it. So the New Testament is not a great source because usually it doesn't locate the place in the city. It's good for certain buildings, which we know then that they existed at that time, and so forth. But it's not good for exact placement or exact dimensions or anything like that. Now, you must remember that this city was completely wiped out in 70 AD, and I mean completely. Very little was left standing, and it has made it very difficult. You can't go back like you can to Babylon, go back and look at the old foundation and kind of picture how the city was laid out. Much of the reconstruction of the city must be done on early historical resources, reading these ancient sources about the city and about how it was set up. Although now there are many excavations going on in Jerusalem, and much work has been done. But still, these ancient sources are a very big source, major source of information. And the most major source is Josephus, whom I'm sure you've heard of in this course. He was, of course, a Jewish historian, and he was the only ancient source that sat down and wrote in a systematic way about the city. Now, he didn't do this, unfortunately, with all of the cities, but he did do it especially for the walls. He said the first wall began at such and such a point. It went, you know, southwest or whatever, and ended in such and such a point. So Josephus is very important in that way because he's one of the few people who actually locate spots in the city. Another major source comes from the time of Constantine, very early 4th century A.D. His mother, Helena, came back, of course Constantine was the first Christianized Roman emperor, and his mother came back and said, I want to find where all of this happened. So she went around and asked people traditionally where these places had been. And the people would tell her, because they carried on a tradition of where the particular spot, the particular building in the city had been. This is, of course, many years later than the time when these events happened. But you can't completely discount tradition. Tradition is actually, when we say tradition has sets like the upper room as being here, as having been here, that's usually Helena. She went around and said, where do you think that the upper room was? And the people said, oh, you know, my great-great-grandfather told me that it was here. And when we speak of tradition as setting aside, it is usually from her. Now, of course, this is our least reliable source, but still is somewhat significant. You can't totally discount it. And, of course, our next other source is archaeology. Jerusalem was very fortunate in many respects as far as archaeology goes, because archaeology here did not begin until relatively late in the 19th century on a massive scale. There were some early excavations. On a massive scale, it didn't really begin until the 1860s. That is very significant because early archaeologists were very, very bad. They usually took all the things like potsherds, pieces of pottery, you know, and just threw them out. So these are insignificant broken pots and everything. Well, that's the major dating method that archaeologists today use in dating the city, is they look at the pottery. Because pottery dating is very, you have a very, very good stratigraphy with the pottery. Pottery is something which always is preserved, basically. So you have thousands upon thousands upon thousands of pieces of pottery, and you can easily set up, during this period, they were using this type of pottery. During this period, they were using this type of pottery. It's very, very distinctive. You can also set up trade routes using the pottery. You find a piece of pottery that came from Greece over in Jerusalem. You say they must have had a large trade system. Must have been trading. Somehow they got this piece of pottery. But the early archaeologists just threw all this stuff away. They also threw all the little tools, all the tools and everything away. They were interested in gold, marble, you know, big fancy things. And they threw away almost everything that the archaeologists today use to determine what daily living was like. So Jerusalem was very fortunate in that archaeology did not begin very early here. Also, it was fortunate because it was a sacred site. They kept many of these old materials, which normally they would have thrown out because it was a sacred city, and therefore they felt that they could not just dump the stuff and throw it out. The Palestine Exploration Society, one of the major people who excavated the site in early years, Palestine Exploration Fund, that is. Also, Kathleen Kenyon, well, the Palestine Exploration Fund excavated around 1865 to not 1869. Then Kathleen Kenyon, who I'm sure you've heard of, excavated 1961 to 1967, and then went back and has excavated through the years sporadically in this area. The Hebrew University is a major excavator today, although I cringe when I hear the Israelis are excavating, because they also are not fantastic archaeologists. They're very good archaeologists, but they have a tremendous amount of pressure from the government on them to get out there and find something big. And as a result, they go in and they bulldoze, and that's the way they excavate. And American archaeologists sit down and cry when they hear that, because they go in with the toothbrushes and the trowels, They're very, very fine words. Take out everything, photograph absolutely everything that comes out of the site, photograph it in situ where they find it, and then take it out and photograph it and have it very, very well marked and everything. And when the Israelis come in and their sites and just come in with a bulldozer and bulldoze everything up, and as a result, they don't find any of the fine details. They only find big, major things. But there is a lot of activity going on today. Kathleen Kenyon has excavated some in the Tyropean Valley, some near the temple. There are other many excavations around the walls, especially around the walls, to find their location. Now, I'd like to, you probably have a lot of background in the background of the New Testament, so I don't want to give a lot of history of the city, but I do want to briefly give you some history of the city. And you'll hear more of this in Intertestament period, which I suppose you haven't taken yet. Okay. Well, when you get to that, what I said about the city will sound familiar, because the major significant part of this particular city, as it was in AD 66, comes from the Intertestament period, the character of the city and so forth. The city was set up by David. He took the Jebusite fortress. David's city is this section, right here, just one little section. If any of you want to stand on chairs when I get to explaining things here, I don't think you can hurt these chairs. Anyway, the original city was here. Of course, David had the temple site, but he didn't build the temple, of course. Solomon, his son, built the temple. This is about 950 BC. This is not Solomon's temple. We have no remains of Solomon's temple, really have no idea except from the Bible what Solomon's temple looked like. There's no foundations or anything to be found today. In 586, the Babylonian captivity occurred. People were taken captive, the city was destroyed, the temple was destroyed, and so forth. The rebuilding of the temple began under Cyrus in 536 BC, and then was completed under Zerubbabel. And the second temple was called Zerubbabel's temple. Now, this isn't Zerubbabel's temple either, so I'll get to this temple, which one this is. then, later, the walls were rebuilt under Nehemiah. This is about 444 BC, for anyone who's really interested in the chronology. In 332 BC, Alexander the Great took control from the Persians and consequently conquered this whole area. Now, Alexander died very shortly thereafter, and he hadn't left an heir. He had one son who was retarded or something. He was, anyway, mentally incompetent. So he couldn't rule, and therefore Alexander's kingdom was split up among his generals, which was really a mess. They spent the next several hundred years fighting over it. And this area, being kind of in the middle between Egypt down there and the general who was up in this whole area, was a battleground this whole time. Here you see Jerusalem. And it was a battleground between the Egyptians and between us here. Finally, Antiochus III won. He was a Seleucid. Oh, right. And this began the Seleucid reign. Over this whole area. That was 198. A lot of the information during this period comes from the Book of Maccabees, which is an apocryphal book, but the first Book of Maccabees is very accurate historically when it speaks of this period. You can't trust everything in it, but basically it's very good and is a major source of information about this period. So is Josephus. But of course, you'll see this with a lot of this information from over the past. Now, Antiochus IV was Antiochus Epiphanes, who you know from the Old Testament, and he reduced Jerusalem, the city of Jerusalem, to the lowest state which it had during its whole history. He was a Hellenist. He was well, he was a fellow Eustace, but he believed the Greek civilization was the greatest civilization the world had ever known, and everybody should be Greek, regardless of what they were. They should all be Greek. So they should all dress like Greeks, worship like Greeks, eat like Greeks, and everything. Well, he tried to enforce this on the Jews, who had a history of being very stubborn and not liking to have things forced on them. And the worst point was when he entered Jerusalem and he set up an altar to Zeus on the temple altar and sacrificed pigs on it, which, of course, was an unclean animal and was absolutely the worst thing that could have happened. Well, immediately, or very shortly thereafter, a Hasmonean priest of the line of the Hasmoneans, who were a line of priests of the Jews, he started the revolt. His name was Matthias or Mattathias, spelled different ways. And his son, under Judas the Maccabee, became it. These are Maccabeans. And Judas finally entered the Jerusalem and cleansed the temple, rededicated it, proclaimed an 8-day feast, which has become Hanukkah. That's where the holiday Hanukkah comes from. And then the fighting continued, but finally they did become independent from the Seleucids and set up the Maccabean period, or the Hasmonean period. It's usually called the Hasmonean period because the Hasmonean dynasty ruled this area. The rule was the high priest, the priestly line actually ruled, so you didn't have the separation of the two at this point. Then in 63 BC, Rome took over this area. And the main reason that they were able to take over this area and they was because the last two people of this whole line, Salome Alexandra's children, Salome Alexandra was the last real Hasmonean ruler. She obviously was not a priest, but she gave the internal rule. The rule of the city was given over to the priest under her rule. She kept control of foreign affairs and actually was pretty good at it. But her sons both decided they wanted to rule, and they didn't want to just one of them have the priesthood and one of them have the rule. They decided they wanted both wanted to have everything. And they fought bitterly for a number of years. They were Aristobulus and Hyrcanus. The Romans finally came in, and because of the internal war between these two brothers, it made it very, very bad for the Jews, because Rome came in, set up Hyrcanus as ruler, and really had to devastate large areas of this whole of Palestine in order to conquer them. Whereas if there had been one ruler who could have mediated with Rome, they would have been in a much better situation. Pompey dismantled some of the walls of the city, which were then shortly rebuilt, but he allowed Hyrcanus to remain an ethnarch, an ethnarch being from the ethnic, being a native ruler, but who was under the Romans. In 37 BC, Roman troops set up Herod as king. Now, the reason they did that, Antipater was Hyrcanus' main counselor. He was not Jewish. He was an Idumean. Let's see, that is I-D-U-M-E-A-N. Idumean. The Idumeans kind of considered themselves to be Jewish. Nobody else considered them to be Jewish. The Jews looked at them as kind of half-Jewish. Great misgivings that the Jews had of the Idumeans. Well, Antipater was Hyrcanus' main counselor, and he was happy to remain Hyrcanus' main counselor. But his son decided he didn't like that. So when Antipater was killed, was assassinated, Herod basically took over the rule. He had, in the meantime, married Mariamne, whom, of whom one of these towers, the tower with the two rings on it there, was made in honor of. He married her. She was of the Hasmonean line, so he thought this would give him some kind of legitimacy, that even if he weren't a Hasmonean, he was, after all, kind of half-Jewish, and he did marry a woman who was of the Hasmonean line. However, he later had her put to death, and her father, and her children, and her brothers. So that kind of wiped out the whole rest of the Hasmonean line right there. Anyway, Herod was set up as king, and the Jews, for the most part, couldn't stand him, ever. Very few of them really liked him, but he was a friend of Mark Antony. When Antony was defeated, Herod went to Octavian and said, you know, I'll be a friend of yours, too, and switched sides very, very quickly at just the right moment, and so he became a very, very close friend of Octavian, the emperor. So he maintained rule control over this whole area and ruled it until 4 BC. So notice our Christian calendar is off a few years. We know that Jesus was born before Herod the Great died, but our calendar, the people who set up the Christian calendar, kind of were off. So the dates are slightly wrong there. They're off by 4 to 6 years. We don't know exactly. Herod was a great builder. That was one reason the Romans liked him. He did make such beautiful, beautiful buildings. The temple is the result of Herod. Now, Zerubbabel's temple was still standing, the second temple. But he decided he wanted to beautify it, that he wanted his city to be the most beautiful city in the world. So he basically took it down and rebuilt it and made it much larger, enlarged the court by about 2 times. The court is about 2 times larger than the Zerubbabel's court, and really did beautify it. As one Jewish rabbi said, if you haven't seen Herod's temple, you've never seen a beautiful building. So it was really a beautiful edifice, white marble with a lot of gold, a lot of gilt. I will speak more of that in a while. This is Herod's palace complex. There were the three towers. This was the city. He realized the city was a little bit weak, could be attacked from this area, and needed to be strengthened. And he built this whole fortress partly as a means to strengthen the defenses of the city. Herod was very, very conscious of the need to strengthen the defenses of the city, and actually he was responsible for building the walls which repulsed the Romans in the beginning of their siege of the city in 66 AD. He built the second north wall, which is called, these walls are called different names, different numbers. Yeah, that would still be the second. Okay, you see the, I'm pointing down here because I came in late, but the second north wall, that's one, the outside wall, the next wall in is the second wall. I'm not quite that strong. Maybe someone could point to it or something. It's right beside the fortress there. Yeah, okay. That Herod built because he realized that the city was very, very weak from that angle. Note, the last wall, the furthest wall out, was not built while Jesus was here on earth. If you remember, Calvary was outside the city walls. That third wall was built later during Herod Agrippa's reign, 41 to 44 AD. It was begun. It was not finished by the time that when the revolt broke out. When the Jews very, very hastily finished the wall, and did kind of a sloppy job of it, because they didn't have many materials. The city had been completely closed off by the Romans by that time. And that's one reason why the third wall, or the first wall in this model, they're either numbered 1, 2, 3 or 1, 2, 3. And it depends on which way you're numbering them. In this diagram, it's wall number 1. That wall was breached by the Romans very quickly in the siege of the city because it had not been finished properly. Incidentally, some of these walls are in the neighborhood of 50 feet high. These are not little little 10-foot-high walls or something. They're monstrously huge things. These towers, some of these towers are in the neighborhood of 70, 80 feet high. I say in the neighborhood because I'm converting meters to feet, and I'm not very good at that. So I can only give you a rough within 5 or 6 feet or so. Another building project that Herod did was there's an amphitheater here. He was very much like the Greek civilization also, so he built a lot of Greek things. Hippodrome here. If you've ever seen Ben-Hur, you know what a hippodrome is. It's the thing they race the chariots around. This started revolt because it was put right smack in the Jewish section of the city, and the more orthodox, thank you, the more orthodox section of the city, and started a revolt. Herod, as I said, was not well liked. He kept control of the city during his whole reign, but there were numerous revolts of the Jews. There was a revolt. He built the temple, and everyone thought, oh, gee, maybe Herod isn't such a bad guy after all. You know, but then, when he finished building the temple, he put a Roman eagle right on the temple right there and started a huge revolt. Naturally, they put this pagan symbol right on the temple, and he did back down on that one. He took it down. But he had problems. There's, just to show you something of the character of Herod, the story of these three towers is interesting. This tower is Tower of Babel. It was erected to his brother, Babel, who had died, had committed suicide in captivity. The Parthians had captured him, and he committed suicide. These other two towers have an interesting story. Herod had married Mary Amy, and he really did seem to love her, married her for love, and which was very rare in those days and everything. But he also was very jealous, and he went off to Rome and left Mary Amy in charge of a friend of his. Came back, and apparently for no reason whatsoever, except that his sister, Salome, didn't like Mary Amy, and she kind of was the instigator of the whole thing. He got very, very jealous, and had both his friend and Mary Amy put to death. Then, realizing what he had done, and although this wasn't a spur-of-the-moment thing, I mean, he put her on trial and everything, so it wasn't like a half-hour decision or something. But after it happened, he was so remorseful at having done that that he was actually sick and nearly died because of this. But then he got over it and came back and built a tower in honor of them. And this is the Tower of Mary Amy. This is in honor of his wife, which shows something of his character. And as I said, he ended up putting to death her two sons and her father, her grandfather, her brother, I think her mother. But anyway, it was kind of the Roman emperor to say, I'd rather be one of Herod's swine than one of his relatives. Which had even more poignancy because, of course, Jews don't eat swine. And Herod was not fully Jewish, but he was half Jewish. So when you hear someone challenge, say, oh, I've heard this a number of times, challenge the slaughter of the innocents, the slaughter of the children in Bethlehem, and say nobody could really do that, although I don't know why they would say that. I mean, we have Hitler in our modern day, so you know, you can see that people certainly do things like that. It's fully in Herod's character, fully within his character. In fact, when he died, when he was ready to die, he said he knew that Jerusalem would rejoice when he was dead. He said, I want the city to mourn for me. So he had them gather all of the major Jewish leaders into one place and said, as soon as I'm dead, kill them all. That way the city will mourn when I die. This was not carried out. His advisors were a little smarter than that. So they didn't actually carry it out, but that shows what sort of a person he was. Shortly after Herod, the rule of the procurators was set up. That is, the rule was taken away from the Jews. There was no longer an ethnarch, but they set up actual Roman rulers. These rulers were appointed by Rome, they came and ruled the city. They were very, very bad, all of them. Pontius Pilate was the 5th. They didn't have a very long history either, and they didn't last very long. They usually, a revolt started out and they were recalled and another one was sent. They overtaxed the people. They didn't live in Jerusalem, which would have been the logical place for them to live. They lived in Caesarea, which was a Greek city which Herod had built. And they lived there and they ruled from there. They had no notion of what was going on in the Jewish nation. They had no contact to speak of, minimal contact, with the leaders of the Jews. And therefore there was constant friction. And finally, of course, the revolt started, broke out, and lasted 3.5 years. Jerusalem was finally destroyed. It was a long, long siege of Jerusalem. It's hard to say exactly how long it was because it was started and then it broke off because the Roman general decided he was going to go back and proclaim himself emperor, which he did. Titus went back and things were bad in Rome, so he thought this was a very propitious time, so he went back, declared himself emperor, and after a year or so sent his son back to finish the siege. So the siege is actually in two stages. The city was completely cut off by the Romans, so they could get no supplies or anything into the city. It was really a terrible war. If you start reading Josephus, it's really agonizing to read. He's very graphic. They had a civil war going on inside the city between the moderates and the radicals. The whole time the siege was going on, people were being killed left and right inside the city because the two groups were bitterly opposed to each other. There were the zealots who believed that we should overthrow Rome, and then there were the moderates who didn't think that it was possible to overthrow Rome. But they had not left the city when they could have, and then the city was closed off and they were stuck. Then there was starvation, to tremendous famine in the city after a while. And finally, the Romans did break through. They broke through from the north, each of the walls, 1, 2, 3. The third wall and the temple complex were very, very difficult to take, very, very well fortified. But they finally were taken, and then the whole city was razed, just completely wiped off the map, as an example to anybody who would want to fight with Rome. That they better not try it because this is what would happen to them. And it was actually rather effective. These Jews were actually, that didn't finish the revolt. It finished it for a time. Then in 135, Bar Kokhba started a revolt. And this was then the last revolt. You've heard of Masada, I'm sure. The last stand and the final complete wiping out of that whole revolt and everything. And then the Jews were not even allowed into the city of Jerusalem, into this area, for a good while. And then the city was rebuilt. They were allowed back in. The city was rebuilt and went through, I think it's nine different people owning the city at the time. Yeah. Was rebuilt and belonged alternately to the Romans, the Byzantines, the Arabs, Crusaders, Arabs, Turkish, British, Jordanian, and Israelites. You see what kind of history this whole area has had. And before that, it was at once Seleucid, Persian, Babylonian, and so forth. It's quite a crossroads. Seems kind of out of the way to us, but it really was a crossroads. The geography of Jerusalem is about 14 miles to the Dead Sea and about 33 miles to the Mediterranean. Originally, I think David probably built the city mainly because of its strongly defensible position. It's 2,500 feet elevation. Is on a very strategic location, very easy to defend and to hold, especially David's city, which was this part. You've got the Valley Kidron here, you've got the Valley Hinnom here, and you've got the Tyropean Valley here, which gradually was filled in over the years. The Tyropean Valley used to be considerably bigger, and if you go there now, it's even smaller than it was at this time. Because of the debris from all the destructions of the city. In fact, some very profitable excavations had been carried on in the Tyropean Valley, digging through all the debris. So this was very easy to defend, and I think that was one of the main reasons the city was built. The city originally was basically an agricultural community. In the early Hellenistic period, it was mainly agricultural. The trade had not really been developed yet when the Greeks took over the city. There would be a lot of little towns around the city, a lot of plots of land which were exploited, were planted, grain was grown, many kinds of fruits, many kinds of vegetables. Cattle were raised, had a large supply of cattle, especially as the city became a strong religious center and there were more and more Jews. They had more and more market for the animals for the sacrifices. So it was a large cattle-raising area. Later in the Hellenistic period, and then on into the Hasmonean period and into the Roman period, the city had become a major trade route. Trade came from Jaffa in Herod's time. This had become actually, had been a major route to Jerusalem. In fact, this is the Jaffa Gate. This is frequently spelled Jaffa with two A's in the same place. The difference in transliteration. Herod built Caesarea because the Palestine needed a better port. Jaffa was not a very good port. This was a much better port. And it there became a major, major trade route to Jerusalem from Caesarea. This was a major trade route in this direction, major east-west trade route. So it was kind of a center of trade. And they traded all sorts of merchandise. There were artisans, skilled craftsmen in Jerusalem who made all sorts of gold and silver stuff to export, plus just normal ordinary crafts, you know, making tools and so forth, and they could export them from Jerusalem. And of course you had pilgrims just flooding the city. The city was probably, it's hard to say, the city was probably 100,000 people at this time. That's a conservative estimate. I've seen much larger estimates. That's what Aviona estimates. I've seen much larger estimates than that. I've not seen any really smaller than that. So it's hard to say, hard to estimate how big a city was then. That's roughly, probably a pretty good estimate, 100,000, maybe more than that. During the time when the pilgrims came, there were 3 pilgrimages to Jerusalem a year. There would be maybe 300,000 pilgrims just swarm into this whole area. That, again, is a conservative estimate. Josephus says there were 3 million, but that's hardly conceivable. As one commentator said, you couldn't stand 3 million people shoulder to shoulder in the city of Jerusalem at this time. So you have to take Josephus with a grain of salt. You pretty much ignore his numbers and because he always exaggerated numbers of everything. So, but during the time when the pilgrims came in, this would be just a tremendous trade center and the people would come, you know, come to for a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and also the merchants would come expecting to make some good deals and everything. So it was a major, major center. You notice the city is broken up into different sections. These are very important. This section here, the upper city, and David's city, for a long time were very antagonistic to each other. In fact, they were basically separated for many years. They were under the Hasmoneans, were joined in, united more strongly than they had been previously. There had actually been some fighting between the two sections of the city, sporadically. Under the Hasmoneans, this ceased, but there was still great rivalry. You can see that this city had made its own wall. It made its own wall on this side, partly against David's city. And then later, this was to be a very good position for them, because the Romans, after conquering all of this, had to still conquer this when they came in. So it was a very good strategy. The reason there was such rivalry, this was much more Orthodox Jewish people in here. This was the Greek section of the city. That is, they were Jews for the most part, but they were Hellenistic Jews. They liked the Greek culture. They went along with the Greek culture. You can notice the buildings are bigger here. That's for a purpose. The wealthy people mainly lived in this section. A few wealthy people lived in this section who were the more Orthodox Jews. But for the most part, the Sadducees were located in this whole area. You know, the Sadducees and the Pharisees never did get along too well, except when they were trying Jesus. One of the few times they ever got together for anything. The Pharisees were, of course, more Orthodox Jewish section. Big skilled workers area in here, in this section of the city. This was also quite Jewish. That's why the Volga started when the Hippodrome was built. Sanhedrin met here. There's a little building there. You can't really see it unless you come right up to the model and look at it. There's a little building in there. The Sanhedrin, the Council of the Jews, met there. You, if you come up and look at this sometime, you'll see there's some archways here. There's a bridge going from the temple wall over to this wall, so you could go directly into the upper city without having to climb down and go through here and climb back up and go along. The Wailing Wall is located right here. Very significant to the Jews. It's the closest point that they can get to where their temple was. It's also one of the very, very few places where they can have, where there are actually Herodian stones. There are only a few of these, like two or something as well, a big high wall, but most of the wall is Arab and Crusader. But the very bottom of it comes from this actual period. And it is, as I said, very significant. It's the closest they can get to the temple because the Dome of the Rock, the big Muslim mosque, is sitting right where the temple was. And obviously the Jews aren't allowed into a Muslim mosque. And the Wailing Wall today, if you go there, you'll see frequently the Hasidic Jews. They have separated men and women at the Wailing Wall. The Hasidic Jews are the more Orthodox Jews. Are there constantly. You can't take pictures of them or anything. My husband found that out when he was over there. And they have a separated men and women. And they have a big court. They've cleared this whole area out now. It's a huge court. I'll go on with the sections of the city. This was kind of a newer section of the city, although not the newest. There were a lot of markets in here, too. It was a big industrial bigdom. Not industrial, but big marketplaces were in here. Herod decided it should be more protected. That's why he built the second wall. The fortress there is the Antonia. That is built on the foundations of the Baris, which was built during the Hasmonean period, which was a fortress, B-A-R-I-S. The Antonia, also called the Praetorium, you know, which is called on here, called the Antonia. Was built, it housed Roman soldiers. There was always a legion of Roman soldiers in there. There was a tunnel between the fortress and the temple area because most revolts started in the temple area, so the few of these soldiers could come flying out that tunnel and attack the mob in the temple area. It was very, very well fortified. You see the funny little arches there and the funny little round things there. That's the sheep market. Right on the side of the wall there. The monument you see there is a monument from Maccabean times. This, as I said, the furthest wall was not in existence when Jesus was on earth. You notice the three crosses and the little hill there. That's Gordon's Calvary. There are two possible sites for Calvary. That has a lot of weight on it. Gordon went and looked at that site. There's a big stone there which looks like a skull. Of course, we know that it was Golgotha, the place of the skull. There's arguments back and forth over whether it looked like a skull back then or not. Nobody really knows. But it is outside the wall. It was definitely outside the wall. Also, there's a garden beside it. And that garden is definitely from this period. It's a very, very old garden. And recently, there have been refound remains of a church there from 200, which shows that at that early date, the people felt it was a sacred site. So it's highly possible that the garden tomb was somewhere in that garden. The traditional site is on the side of this wall, further up, right before that gate. There's much dispute over that. That was Helen's finding. Much dispute over that. You wonder what we don't know whether the wall was actually outside that site or inside it. And of course, if the wall was outside it, then that couldn't be the correct location. The temple area, I'll tell you a little bit about the temple area. The huge court, the mountain was pretty much leveled to build this. Herod, in fact, leveled that site and built this site up. Built up a superstructure, or understructure, substructure, underneath this to make a much larger court because the top of the mountain, this is Mount Moriah, the mountain was, rounded, and he had to flatten it. It's quite a work. You notice there are little buildings in underneath the wall here. There's a big balustrade And there was room for little rooms, like meeting rooms and everything. Underneath here, there were also many activities which took place. On the other side of the court, there was a place where there was a scrollery, a place where there was canned leather to make the scrolls for the Holy Scripture and where they actually copied it. So this was a huge court. This was not a little bitty court which contained only the temple. It was a mammoth structure. It contained many, many things. This was the court of the Gentiles. Gentiles could come into this court through the Golden Gate, also called the Eastern Gate, which is now bricked up. They could come in, they could go no further. The second court was the court of the women. Well, women lived in those days. So the women could go here, the Jewish women, and they could go no further. You notice these little corner things. These were areas, too. These were little buildings. One of them was where the Nazarites stayed when their vows were about up, waiting for their vows, to the time of their vows, to end. One was a storage place for wood, one for oil, and one where lepers could come. And there was a ritual bath there for the lepers. This is the court of the men. The Jewish men could go here. And you see the altar with the ramp on that side, and there's a laver for cleansing. There's a laver right here. This is the counter gate. There were choirs that on those circular steps that sang the psalms. There's circular steps right in front of that gate. And then you have the temple itself, and the priests could go into the first section of it, but they could not go into the back section of it. That was the Holy of Holies. Only the high priest could go in once a year. And the priest could address the people from the porch there in front of the temple. You see the little tower beside there. That was a tower, much like they have over there today in many places, where man would stand up in the tower and call out when he saw the sun rising and the sun setting. They knew the new day, of course their day began with the sunset, knew exactly when their new day had begun. It was also important for feast days. You would call out and that would be the beginning of the feast or the beginning of a particular holy day. You notice there's a rock underneath here. That's because there really is a rock underneath there. The rock is still there under the dome of the rock. This was Mount Moriah, where Abraham was to have offered Isaac. And it was a very holy place. So when they built the temple, they left the top of the mountain, the very top stone of the mountain, and they didn't level it. If you go in the dome of the rock today, you still see this huge. My husband says, I've never been over there. My husband says it's absolutely mammoth. Huge big stone in the middle of the mosque. Because, of course, the Muslims consider it to be holy also. The aqueduct here was originally thought to have been built by Pontius Pilate, but I was reading a very recent source, and they think that it was probably built in the Hasmonean era. Now, and that Pontius Pilate just rebuilt it or renovated it. This was a major source of water. The city of Jerusalem had only two sources of water that were always good, always there. The Virgin Spring, the Virgin Fountain, and the Pool of En-Rogel. These were artesian wells, and they always had water in them. Obviously, this is outside the wall, so in a time of siege, you're going to have some difficulty running out there and grabbing it, dodging spears, arrows, and so forth. you had a similar problem with this. So in Hezekiah's day, they built a tunnel, an 1,800-foot tunnel. It was quite an engineering feat of those days. Right across here to this pool here, made a pool here that was fed by this spring, so that then they had a source of water inside the city. Before this aqueduct was built, the only other source of water they had were cisterns and pools where they collected rainwater. These were phenomenally large. Every house had at least one. Many houses had two, three huge cisterns. So you'd walk around the city and there'd be pools all over the place. Because they had to conserve their water so carefully. I think I'd better finish. I have a lot more I could say. I always have a lot more I could say. But I'd be happy to answer any questions. Oh, I should mention a few things. This is the Mount of Olives. That's the Garden of Gethsemane on the edge of that. You can still go there today. There's a garden there. These tombs are not really significant. There were tombs all over the city. The city was covered with tombs. You'll see Tomb of Absalom, Tomb of Zechariah, I think. and so forth. These are the traditional names of the tombs. Definitely are not Absalom and Zechariah. They don't come positively not that old. In fact, most of the tombs are the same way. They're named for some famous person, and they really have nothing to do with that person. So I think I'll end there. And then if anyone wants to ask me any questions, yes.
Okay. How closely did Herod make his temple to that of Solomon, or did he follow the Moses temple?
Not very closely. The Holy of Holies was, you know, patterned after it pretty well. The court, definitely not. The three courts, not really. He kind of made a lot of that up himself. So, in fact, Zerubbabel's temple was not, didn't follow tremendously closely.
Concerning the two possible crucifixion sites, were both of them definitely outside the wall, the second wall at that time, or is there a debate about
it? No, that's the traditional Calvary, which is on the other side of this wall, in this model, may well have been inside the wall. The second wall has not been excavated fully enough to tell us that, but there's a great possibility that it was actually inside the wall, in which case it would be ruled out immediately.
But there's no question about the other one.
There's no question about the other wall outside the wall. Yeah.
Have these little round top nuts been chosen purposely to represent what typically Jewish homes look like?
Well, somewhat. Not completely, because I think these are octagonal. Hexagonal, and the homes weren't really. But a lot of them were like Waddle and Daub, were clay, were stone. The stone was, of course, would be shaped differently. How many of them did look kind of like that? Little hut-like thing. Then the city had a lot of stone, though. A lot of stone kind of row houses. And they still do if you go there. You go into the old sections, and the streets were just wide enough for my husband to walk down them. And they had stone, no doors, just a doorway. You could look back inside it. See a hole in the wall with fire in it, which is the oven. And, you know, that still exists today. Yes.
Did you mention what that thing is going out to the back over there? Was that, you say, aqueduct right where you're...
This aqueduct?
Oh, that's what that is? Okay.
Yes, that's the aqueduct.
And that brought water from where?
It brought water from near Hebron, which is about, I think, about 15 to 20 miles away. No more than 20. But the aqueduct itself was 50 miles long because they had to wind it and everything to get the gradient right to run the water. And it couldn't build it tall enough to start and go straight. So they had to make it wind. So it was actually 50 miles, about 50 miles long. Any more questions? Okay.